B3. Number 19B.
Can you see this first law on which Mrs. Eddy relies? That's why we have soul as identity, because she sees that the identities of being are unchangeable. They have an unchangeable identity, that what is spirit will always be spirit. It will never be matter, it will never materialize, it will never be anything but spirit good. That good is good and can never be evil. And we think, well, this is kindergarten reasoning. In a way it is, and yet it's very deep. Just to see, because we will soon find that this is not so obvious, if we go on, that actually these laws are not absolutely valuable. But just for the first step, you would say, oh yes, that's what is all over the place in Mrs. Eddy's textbook, that God is God, remains God, it's never anything but God, good is good and never is evil, so it is as the law of identity. If we take the law of non-contradiction, the second one, we could say that God, good, spirit is not, therefore, you see, is not the opposite, is not evil matter. That God, good, spirit cannot be evil matter. See, I take, to make it very simple, always the same starting point of God, good, spirit, because really this is the tone of the fourth chapter in the textbook, where she begins for the first time really to reason from God, spirit, good, and uses there for the first time really the classical logic as a starting point. So can you see that this too is all over the place, that she argues in hundreds of ways that good cannot be evil, that spirit is good and spirit cannot be good and evil, so that there is identity and non-contradiction. That being, what it is in nature, does not contradict itself. So the law of identity, the law of non-contradiction, is used also in Christian Science. Let's take 3, the law of the excluded middle, and we had there A and B. Let's take as A, again we start with God, good, spirit, cannot be good and evil, spirit and matter. Can you hear the textbook? It's all over. Always saying that spirit is spirit and not the opposite, and therefore cannot be good and evil, spirit and matter. Or let's take the second variation, 3b. We would say God, good, spirit. Again we start, God, good, spirit, cannot be good, spirit, at one time, and evil, or matter, at another time. This is, say, the fundamentals of Christian Science logic, and we think this is so simple and so natural, that we feel, well, why bother about it? This is evident. And we'll see that it is not evident, and that this logic is not the logic of Christian Science, though it appears to be so. So this is really the great point. And you know also the Bible naturally writes not in the classical logic. The Bible was anyway written at the time before classical logic was known. Classical logic, Aristoteles, was in the 4th century BC. The Bible was written mostly in the 5th, 6th, and 7th century BC. So it was written at a time nobody knew anything about logic, nor was thinking about logic. And therefore you have these terrific statements in the Old Testament where she says, where the Bible says, I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Now, you see, I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. If we would now analyze this statement through the three laws of Aristotelian logic, we would see that it breaks all the three laws. And yet this is Bible teaching and considered high spiritual teaching. And it is. And it is. The point is that it can be misunderstood, that when, you see, that when we read that statement from the classical logic, then we can understand why theology of today teaches that God is good and evil. That's quite natural now. But if we approach it from then the new logic, I will come back to this, then we see that this statement is true, but has a completely different meaning than the classical logic gives to it. That's the big difference. We don't change the statement in the Bible, but with the approach of the transclassical logic, such a statement means something completely different than when we read it with the classical logic. Can you see why, say, understanding of the logic of Christian Science is necessary in order to read the textbook rightly? Else we read the textbook with our classical logic, and therefore we read into it something that is not there. Is that clear? Just to bring out the issue. We come to a third point, dualistic human thinking. Dualistic human thinking. I must give you a little lecture into cultural science and cultural history. Men did not always think the way we are thinking. We are really a child of the Greek classics. But before the Greek classics, there was mankind, there was history, there were cultures, and therefore these pre-classic cultures had also a pre-scientific consciousness. What is that pre-scientific consciousness? I don't want to go into much detail, but we know that primitive men had an archaic consciousness, a slumbering, dreamlike consciousness, that afterwards the magical age had a magical consciousness, the power of the word and of words. We have the mythic period right before the Greek period. Their thinking was molded by legends, by myths. And then only with the Greeks, very late, just recently, just yesterday in human history, the Greeks came. 2,000 years is very little in this evolution of consciousness. So just yesterday, so to say, the Greeks came along and brought the scientific way of reasoning. The pre-scientific period had a consciousness of an undifferentiated whole. They were feeling wedded to the whole, woven into the whole. They had always a very strong feeling just of one universe, and they were part of that one universe. They didn't have a sense of individuality and having an individual identity. They were part of the whole, and the whole mattered. The tribe mattered. The family mattered. The individual didn't matter. The whole, they were woven into a web of the whole universe, and therefore they were never thinking in a dualistic way. They were thinking in the way of polarity, in complementarities. They had the polarity, say, of heaven and therefore of earth, but it was not dualistic. They had the consciousness of complementarities. They knew when they were speaking about the wife that there is a husband implied. You cannot be a wife without that there is a husband. So the basic question therefore came up, that there was a feeling of one universe. See, it's so important for us, because finally we also see that there is just oneness and one universe. They had that feeling that there exists only one universe and not two universes, we may say so. So why then came up that question of dualism at all? Why suddenly could the Greeks think in a dualistic way when fundamentally they relied on a oneness of the universe? So I think the very first thing we have to see, and which is important, is to see that the fact of oneness that exists is reality as such, and that dualistic thinking is a man-made concept and does not exist in reality. If we see that dualism is not something that is of the nature of reality, not inherent in reality, then we also are beginning to see that the dualistic thinking is actually a man-made concept, so to say a tool for humans to think in an ordered way. And that's how actually dualistic thinking came into existence, namely, as they were thinking along polarities and complementarities, therefore there wasn't yet an opposite, but they were beginning to try to find order in this undifferentiated whole. And the first aspect of order is actually opposite. An opposite begins to order things. So the first principle of ordering was beginning to think in opposites. How? We have very good record actually from the Greeks how it came into being, that they began suddenly to think, here I am as a thinking subject. They were aware of that they are existing and thinking, and they began to see that they were thinking about something outside of themselves. They had a universe outside of themselves, something which stood opposed to them. And so they came to the opposite, opposed to the opposite. So suddenly they began to see that they could arrange the experience of that universe at least in two big universes, so to say, in a subjective, basic sense, and in an objective world. And from that point on we had dualism. Subject and object being two and no more one, as it has been in the mystical period. So actually with this subject object opposition they established the primordial dualistic concept. And yet we must know that man created that. That it doesn't exist in being. It's an ordering principle for human thinking. It isn't the principle that rules the world. It's a human principle that says, in order that I can orient myself in the universe, I must make categories and classifications. The first one they made was that opposite, to think in opposites. So therefore, the first objects were therefore material objects, you see. Can you hear how these terms link together? But they are man-made. That's what Shakespeare knew, when he said there is nothing either good nor bad. Good or bad is the dualistic sense, but thinking makes it so. We make it. The moment we know that we make dualism, we are already over the hump, so to say. We are already on the way of solving the whole dualistic sense of good and evil. Now, why on earth did man need that ordering principle? Well, see, man is not bigger than the whole. So he cannot grasp the whole as a whole. He cannot grasp the whole as a whole. Man's thinking is limited. And the moment you have limitation, you must have lines of demarcation. The moment we have limited concepts, we can differentiate, we can make lines of demarcation, and therefore make the whole smaller, limited. And if we make it limited, then we can grasp it. Then man comes from the root mind, and mind means minding, keeping in mind, turning it over in mind, that's thinking. So man is actually the thinker, the human thinker, and in this way, by making the undifferentiated whole, reducing them into limited parts, man was able somehow to understand his world, to order his world, bring some kind of understanding and comprehension in this world. And that's why from that point on, from the Greeks on, they began to define terms. Define, make finite, therefore define the terms so that it is absolutely distinct from other terms, can be separated from other terms, and in this way build up really a whole language that is differentiated clearly. So comprehension, or human comprehension, I must stress that, demands actually this ability to distinguish, to differentiate, to define, making limits. The moment you can make limits, you can also see that which is opposed to that limit, and we come to the opposite as what? As the extreme form of differentiation. So opposites are always the extreme form of differentiation. And it is therefore extremely interesting to see that the first process of learning was that of using that law of opposites, namely to learn by trial and error. That's how actually the animals learn something. That's what the experience we make with rats and so on. They learn by trial and error. And if we try 1,000 times and then find out that 1,000 once is right, then through 1,000 different trials and errors, we arrive at a conclusion. We learn something. So that this method of trial and error is a learning process. See, it is the extreme sense of the method of approximation. We try and try, and then find out how much is right, how much we fail, and through that learning process, we really arrive at conclusion. Again, we see it is using just the dualistic concept, either it is yes or no. Actually, this is the basis of every computer. The computer calculates only on the on that dualistic value, yes or no, meaning impulse, no impulse. All calculations are being done just on that dual value of an electric impulse and no impulse. And you see, they have not the decimal system, they have the binary system, just relying on two. That two comes from dualism, again comes from doubt. Duo, doubt. What is doubt? Doubt is always that you have two possibilities. There are two bases. And from doubt is derived devil. You see that in the Middle German very easily. It is in German is zwei, Teufel, two, Teufel. Teufel is Teufel, devil. Huh? So that doubt, that dualism is the only devil we have to deal with. Huh? It's the doubting, is it so? Is it not so? So diabolic, devil, dualism, dualism, two, they all have the same root. Once in the classical period that duality sense has been discovered, so to say, and established, one can see that from that time on we have a great mentalization of duality. At first, that duality was much more a duality of subject and material objects. Then little by little it became the duality of subject and conceptual opposites. Right, wrong. Conceptual opposites. And Mrs. Eddy led it further, actually, to the opposite of idea illusion. She took it out of the conceptual opposite into even a finer sense of dualism of idea and illusions. In the period of rationalism, in the French period, Descartes, who is an exponent of that way of thinking, he had a very nice short statement. He said, "Dubito ergo sum," which means I doubt, therefore I am. He was the one who could see that you could always doubt, that you can doubt all. Therefore there are always two cases for everything. And he had only one exception for that, for doubting. And that was the fact that he did doubt. The doubting itself has no opposite. So there was one exception, the fact that I can doubt. Now, can you see that dualism has some value? It has quite some value. It is a way of learning, a help for learning. It is a tool for becoming aware what is true, what is wrong. So it's a very helpful tool. It's a tool actually for overcoming ignorance, because ignorance means that you can have no ordered sense in your universe, that nothing really makes sense. You don't see any relationship between the various things in your universe. It's therefore an amorphous sense of oneness and not a differentiated sense of oneness. And you can see that this, therefore, the classical reasoning brought us out of mysticism, which believes in a oneness that is undifferentiated. And so it is, therefore, a terrific tool for education. Yes. So we can see that we should not just take dualism and dualistic thinking as something which we can throw right overboard, but at least we must give it the right place value within the whole realm of thinking. All right, we make a break here.